Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more. Straight talk. No nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
March 25th, 2015. Good morning, Talking Law fans. This is your host, Dan Hochheiser, broadcasting to you live from Lower Manhattan, just east of the Freedom Tower. We are here to entertain you, educate you, and include you in the conversation of all the hottest legal issues of the day. This is an interactive show, Talking Law Radio. We want you to contact us. You can email the show at talkinlaw@gmail.com. Remember, no G in talking, talkinlaw@gmail.com. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/talkinlaw. Follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, Hochheiser. Last week's show was fantastic. We had Utah attorney Mitch Velos, who is the author of Self-Defense Laws of All 50 States. If you're interested in what force you're allowed to use and when you're allowed to use it, listen to last week's show, and you can listen to all our prior episodes, at blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw or on iTunes. So check out all our prior podcasts at blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw or on iTunes. What are we going to do today? We have a great show. We have a guest here with us who literally wrote the book, A New York State DWI Defense. We will get his thoughts on a high-profile case that is in the news. We're also going to talk to him about what to do if you're pulled over by the police and have been drinking. We will then go to the question of the day, which concerns drunk driving. We will get Beth Karras to give us all the latest news on the Robert Durst drama and various cases. Then we will answer the question of the day, and that will be a show. Now, let me introduce our guest. Our guest today is Peter Gerstenzang. Mr. Gerstenzang is the senior partner in the Albany, New York law firm Gerstenzang, O'Hearn, Hickey, and Gerstenzang. He specializes in DWI and vehicular criminal defense. He is certified as a breathalyzer operator. He taught for 12 years at the New York State Police Academy in its breath test training program. Mr. Gerstenzang is also a regent and founding member of the National College for DUI Defense. He is the author of Handling the DWI Case in New York, which is basically the New York DWI lawyer Bible, so to speak. And without further ado, Peter, are you with me?
Yes. Good morning, Dan. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Good.
Great. Thanks so much for taking the time this morning. I want to start out by getting your thoughts on this terrible tragedy in Staten Island, which occurred this past weekend on Saturday, involving New Jersey police officer Pedro Abad Jr., who unfortunately drove the wrong way in Staten Island and had his car destroyed by a truck, which killed two of his passengers and injured himself and a fourth passenger. What are your thoughts on this case, and is there evidence that he was driving drunk as far as you understand?
Well, I just read the one article that you forwarded me about it, and presuming that this does turn out to be, and that's a gross presumption, but turning out to be an alcohol-related fatality, it's basically it's kind of a tip of a very huge iceberg. This is in terms of police officers and alcohol and DWIs. This is a very significant problem for the criminal justice system because there are, unfortunately, an awful lot of police out there who are drinking and driving, and, you know, because they have badges, it creates a situation for other police officers where you're kind of, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. It's a real problem with arresting another police officer. It really puts a police officer on the spot when he stops a car and a police and somebody flashes a badge. It's a problem. I've done, as you pointed out, I've done a lot of police training, and this is just a real tough issue. I mean, the official policy, as far as police administration, is everybody is treated the same. If somebody is stopped and they're driving while intoxicated, they're supposed to get arrested like anyone else. And that's fine if you're a police administrator. But if you're that police officer on the road and you stop another police officer and you arrest him, you expose yourself to all kinds of criticism and problems, and it's just a big issue. There's, you know, it's hard for people to understand, but lawyers, you know, we go into a court, and we may be members of a firm, we may have partners and associates. The law is largely kind of an individualistic type of thing. It's you handle one case at a time. You know, you don't consult about what questions to ask on cross-examination. Police work, on the other hand, is a team sport. It is not something you do alone. You're in a police department. You're part of a team. You're part of a whole culture that you have to fit into and you have to be a part of, and it's vital that you do fit into that. And that culture has all kinds of rules that have to be obeyed. And, you know, one of the cardinal rules is loyalty to a brother or sister officer. For police who are engaged in DWI enforcement, the night is stopping a police officer who's impaired or intoxicated.
Now, Peter Gersten's saying, you know, this case bothers me because this is a police officer who was arrested in February, I believe it was February 26th, 2013 in Rahway, New Jersey, for drunk driving, and he actually had a breath alcohol interlock ignition device on his vehicle, which was removed in September of last year. It's reported that he had approximately 8 prior accidents. I don't know that they were all involving alcohol. Some of them may not have been. But this is a young man. He's only, I believe, 24 years old or so. He's been in 8 accidents. Before the tragedy Saturday, which led to the deaths of 2 people, he posted on Instagram a picture of 3 shots of Jack Daniels, which apparently they were drinking at this strip club in Staten Island. I mean, what can we do better in the system to prevent ticking time bombs like Pedro Abad appeared to be?
Well, okay, assuming that that's the case as far as this individual, I mean, you know, I don't prejudge that. It's obviously, it looks bad, but, you know, certainly as a defense attorney, I don't want to be prejudging that case. But addressing the overall problem is there's a lot of ticking time bombs out there. And it is we've represented all kinds of police officers. In fact, it's like with the NYPD, it's like a set formula where somebody is just charged, they're immediately sent to Marwath in Pennsylvania, which is a residential alcohol program, which is excellent. But then there's both a criminal charge and administrative charges. So it's fine in terms of, you know, people who are actually arrested. My concern is all those folks out there who are not. And see them, we see them where it's a fatal accident or a serious accident where there is no choice but that the person is going to be arrested. And if you look, most of the time that you'll see police officers arrested, it's going to be a scene of an accident or something along those lines where it is clear there is no choice but to make that arrest. And what I mean by that is that the police officers making the arrest literally need coverage in terms of so that they can justify that to other officers. Because, you know, it's one thing if you arrest a cop, a dirty cop who's a thief or a drug dealer. But when we start talking about a police officer who is drinking and driving and gets stopped for speeding or something, and the officer who stops him arrests him, that officer is going to be facing an awful lot of criticism.
You're listening to Talking Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with Peter Gersten Zhang, attorney and author of Handling the DWI Case in New York, which is in which, what edition, Peter? How many editions do you have out there now?
Well, it's been published since 1987 and is an annual edition.
And how can people get the book?
It's West Publishing. Simply go online with West Publishing.
And if you're an attorney in New York that handles DWI cases, this is a must-have book, Handling the DWI Case in New York by Peter Gersten Zhang. Peter, let's move off the Pedro Abad case because, frankly, it's too depressing for me to continue to talk about. Let's answer the question that DWI attorneys are asked all the time when we're out socially, and, you know, the average person wants to know, let's say I had a few drinks, I'm driving in New York, I'm pulled over, and the police stop me. How should I conduct myself during that encounter with the police?
Okay, well, first and foremost, politeness counts. You shouldn't be answering questions. You should insist on speaking to an attorney. But in dealing with the officer, right from the time the lights go off, the appropriate is to pull over. You can first safely pull over as far as you can so you don't have that police officer standing in the road. That immediately demonstrates to the officer that you've got some concern for them by virtue of the fact that there's room for that officer to stand next to that car without being in danger. And then it's a case of, you know, license or registration and a polite, friendly attitude. The officer is asking you to get out of the car, the officer is, to conduct field sobriety tests, you can pretty well figure the officer's already decided you're intoxicated. The field sobriety tests that are conducted roadside, they generally not ask somebody to get out and go through this process that they don't think is intoxicated. In New York City, they don't do field sobriety tests. If you're talking about New York City residents, they do those back at the station. They arrest you first and they take it back to the station and do that. In the rest of the, pretty much the rest of the country and the rest of the state, field sobriety tests are used to establish probable cause and basis for arrest. That's simply just done in New York City. But they'll also ask you to blow into a handheld device on the road. And that handheld device is not an evidentiary test. If you refuse it, it is simply a traffic ticket. If you refuse the test in the station, the evidentiary device, in New York we call a chemical test, you refuse that, you're facing a 1-year revocation of your license, presuming this is your first arrest. So as to whether you should take or refuse the test, if driving is critical to you, if you need to be on that road, if you refuse that test, you're looking at a 1-year revocation. There is a right to a hearing of motor vehicles. In fact, I'm on my way to doing those hearings. Stopped in a rest stop on the freeway. You're entitled to this hearing, but These hearings almost always result in revocation, which leaves you with no driving privileges. The only way you'll be able to drive is if you can get another license, which is called a conditional license, but the only way you can get that is being convicted of DWI or DWAI and getting into the drinking driver program. So when you refuse, what you are opening up is, and you have to drive, you're basically put in a position where you're going to have to plead to and DWI in order to get that conditional license and get into the drinking driver program. So the irony is you could be in a situation where a dismissal of your criminal charge would be a disaster because you would be left just with the refusal revocation and no possibility of getting a conditional license because you don't have the requisite conviction.
Peter, let me just interject for a minute because I understand exactly what you're saying, but I'm trying to play the voice of the average person on the street so that people understand what we lawyers are talking about. And the average person wants to know, okay, Mr. Gerson's saying you wrote this book. I'm out at a restaurant. I had a couple of drinks, two or three drinks, and I'm driving. I get pulled over, and the cop shoves a breathalyzer in my face and says, blow into this. Should I blow or should I refuse?
That's tough. First of all, the law says if he pulls you over for speeding for a traffic infraction, or if he pulls you over or accident, you're required to blow, and it's a violation of law not to. Okay, that test is it's admissible only to show whether you're positive for alcohol or not. So on that one, it's kind of like if you think you're going, you might as well take it. If you think that you're intoxicated, you're probably better off refusing any and all tests, except for the fact that once we get to that test at the station, that chemical test, and you know, they'll read you a refusal warning in regard to that. They don't read your refusal warning in regard to the handheld device. But it's going to depend on you. There's not an easy answer because it depends on your circumstances. The best answer I can give you is this. People think that they can drink a certain amount of alcohol and drive a car. And it depends on the person, but people will think, well, I can have one beer or I can have two beers. Or I can have a beer an hour, all of that. Okay, and well, the reality is that breath testing equipment is highly susceptible to the sample being contaminated, belcher, or burp, or what have you. And on one beer, you can get a very high reading. It'd be an erroneous reading, but you can get that. So the real rule of life and law is you don't drink anything and drive a car. And the concept of having like a half a beer or two beers, taking half an aspirin. It's enough to get you into trouble, but it's not enough to get any kind of an effect or a buzz from drinking. So what I generally tell people is if you're going to drink, enjoy yourself, and have somebody else drive. If you're planning on driving, don't fall. This is an expensive, complicated it's one of the worst charges you can get because it just involves so many things. It's all kinds of aggravation, stress, expense. The best way to win this game is you don't play. Almost never hear of a situation where someone had no alcohol in them and wound up blowing positive on any of these machines.
Peter, I'm very afraid that if people follow the advice you just gave, you are going to be out of business. But on that note, you're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with Peter Gerstensang, who wrote the book Handling the DWI Case in New York, available from West Publishing. All kidding aside, Peter, on this very serious subject, and I have to inject some levity to keep our sanity, let's talk about the elements that the prosecution has to prove in New York State to prove a driving while intoxicated misdemeanor. What are the elements? What do they have to prove?
Okay, well, first of all, they've got to prove operation of a motor vehicle. And operation is not that obviously driving a car constitutes operation. But, you know, the situation where the person's sitting on the side of the road with the engine on really depends on the intent. If you're sitting in a parking lot, getting off a train and sitting in the parking lot because you're too drunk to drive and you turn the engine on for heat and go to sleep, cases have ruled that that's not operation. On the other hand, if you go out, leave the bar and you get into the car and you stick the key in the ignition and begin to turn it, and they stop you right then, if you're manipulating machinery for the purpose of placing the motion, that's operation. So operation is major issues that they have to prove. The other thing they have to prove is that this has to be done on a public highway or a parking lot as defined by vehicle and traffic law. For DWI, they've defined, they've got a special definition for parking lots. They've got to have, you know, it's got to hold four or more motor vehicles. For example, if you were driving drunk in the driveway of a one- or two-family residence, that would not be considered DWI, okay, because that it doesn't fall within, and it's got to be something that's more than a one- or two-family residence. So the person who's pulling into their own home or they're in their driveway and they're, for whatever reason, moving that car and they're drunk, that can qualify. As public highway. So it's operation. They have to prove, obviously, intoxication. They've got to prove that it was on a public highway. And they got to prove it was you, obviously, and put it within the jurisdiction of the court. Those are the central elements.
Now, what is a driving while ability impaired violation offense, and how does a DWAI differ from a DWI misdemeanor?
Okay, the biggest difference, DWI is a crime. If you're convicted, you've got a lifetime criminal record. DWAI is classified in New York as a traffic infraction. If you're convicted of that, it's a traffic infraction, not a crime, which is why so many cases are plea bargained from DWI to DWAI, because the great advantage for your client is they and not a crime. The penalties for DWAI are different in terms of that DWAI is a 90-day suspension versus a 6-month revocation. Evidentially, you got a 0.08, I don't know, 0.08 is a crime in New York, is a DWI. 0.07 is prima facie evidence of impairment. So a hundredth of a point makes the difference between a crime and a traffic infraction. Even more
Talking about blood alcohol content, obviously.
Blood alcohol concentration, yeah. And even more significantly now is the requirement of an inhaler, which is basically a breath test device mounted to the car that you have to blow into in order to start the car. And after you're driving the car for a half hour, at least once every half hour, you've got to give it a rolling test where you have to blow while the car is in motion. This thing does not apply if you're impaired. It does apply to DWI. That's become a huge issue because if you just imagine, it applies to any car you own or operate. So if you and your spouse sharing a car and your spouse is driving carpools, can you imagine the humiliation of having some kids in the car and before you start the car, you're blowing into this device? About the time the parents of the other kids hear that one, that's going to be the end of that carpool. But it's a lot of humiliation. And for a businessman who to drive clients and now has to have an ignition interlock car, or going through, how do you park in New York City? How do you park a car in a parking garage where you've got to turn the car over to an attendant and they're now have to, what, blow into this device to move the car? It just, it's an enormous complication, but that's what you face with a DWI conviction, and you don't face it with a DWAI, driving ability impaired conviction.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with DWI attorney Peter Gerstensang, author of Handling the DWI Case in New York, available from West Publishing. Peter, you know, we drivers don't limit ourselves, of course, to New York. We drive all over the United States. So what differences in state laws across the 50 states should people be aware of in terms of the DWI criminal statutes across the country? Is the New York statute similar to all the other states in the country, or are there some significant differences?
I think there are really some significant differences. I mean, the real key is, if bad enough to drink and drive in New York, you certainly don't want to be drinking and driving in any other state, because you are subject to it. Some have mandatory jail sentences. And most don't have a reduction down to an impaired. It's either you're guilty of a crime or you're not, and they call it DUI, not DWI. What's worse, and the biggest thing you really have to know, is that you're going to be hammered by two states. So if you get convicted in New Jersey for DWI, New Jersey reports this to a national computer. It's picked up by New York, and New York is then going to impose sanctions against you, not as a result of the criminal conviction per se, but administratively, in terms of the Department of Motor Vehicles in New York gets that report, and they will treat that as a conviction in state. So you wind up facing the suspension or the revocation of your license in New York, as well as the loss of your privileges in New Jersey. So it's the only thing worse than being arrested in the state that you're licensed in is to be arrested in the state that you're not licensed in, because whatever happens in that state is going to have repercussions in New York as well. So it's like double jeopardy.
Now, in terms of legislation coming down the pipeline in New York State, is there anything that listeners should be aware of which stands to change DWI laws in New York?
Yes. What has been enacted, which very few people are aware of, is that the Department of Motor Vehicles, under the persuasion of Governor Cuomo, has enacted really, really serious licensing consequences for people. And since their administrative regulations, they claim they can apply them backwards. Our office is presently challenged. We've got a couple hundred cases where we're challenging they are doing to people. But what they're doing is, if you have five convictions over your lifetime, if you're revoked and you have five, you will be revoked forever. And if you're revoked in New York forever, most states will not issue you a license until you clear your situation with New York, which you can't do in your lifetime. If you have three convictions within 5 years, you become revoked. If there's a total of three, you're looking at five. First of all, the regular revocation that rose from the conviction, let's say it's 6 months or a year, then a five-year holding period, followed with no privileges, followed by you can apply after that 5 years to get a restricted license where you drive with an ignition interlock in your car 5 years and with restricted privileges. If you get those three or four convictions, and you have what they call a serious traffic violation, 2 5-pointers within the last 25 years, you're facing a lifetime revocation. So what happens is somebody winds up, they could be revoked for whatever reason, but once that revocation is effected, it opens the door for the Department of Motor Vehicles to look at their entire record. And what might have been thought of as a great plea bargain that results in a revocation suddenly results in that person being revoked for life or being revoked for a much greater period of time.
Peter Gerstensang, thanks so much. Before I let you go, can you just tell our listeners how they could get in touch with your law firm if they want to employ your firm in the future?
Sure. Our phone number is 518-456-6456. That's 518-456-6456. 6456.
Peter Gerson saying, thank you so much for being with me this morning. I appreciate it. I hope you'll come back and talk to us in the future. Care. Okay, now before we get to the question of the day, before we get to Beth Karras, we're going to read the question of the day. The question of the day is, what are the costs of drunk driving in America, and what can be done to reduce drunk driving tragedies like the tragedy involving Pedro Abad Jr. that we just discussed with Peter Gerstenzang. Now, give me Beth.
What can I do?
Talkin' Law Radio brings you a live Karras on Crime special report from Beth Karras, former prosecutor, Court TV, HLN television correspondent, and founder of KarrasOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news.
Beth, what can I do?
Good morning, Beth.
Good morning, Dan.
How are you today?
I'm doing very well. I just can't get enough of this Robert Durst case. I mean, it is just such an involved case. That's what I want to talk about today.
Well, but before we talk about Robert Durst, I want to hear about how you're doing with preparation for the show you're in.
Oh, the Inner Circle Show, the annual charity event, is this weekend, Saturday night. Tickets are still available. They're not cheap, $750, but it's dinner, theater, black tie, who's who in city and state politics as well as media attend. Well, everything's great. I'm ready with my lines, my lyrics, my choreography. I can't wait. We put on a big performance, a dress rehearsal Friday night, which has a crowd about double the size of Saturday night, but it's just our two acts. The mayor's act isn't part of the dress rehearsal. The mayor's act, it will be just Saturday night. Many of the people come really for that, but we're the funny ones as we roast the mayor and other politicians. In any event, we had a little bout of what appears to be food poisoning from last night's rehearsal, so we got 8 cast members down right now. I just hope that they can be at tonight's rehearsal because it's a big one as we block all of the scenes tonight.
Well, I hope everybody gets better, break a leg. Now, let's get to Robert Durst. What is going on with Robert Durst?
Robert Durst, originally a New Yorker, but he has a condo in Houston, is from the wealthy real estate family based here in New York. And this is a guy who's been in the news periodically for decades. Right? He was arrested on March 14th in New Orleans. Authorities believe he was about to flee the country, but he's arrested on a first-degree murder charge out of Los Angeles for a 2000 unsolved case, where his friend Susan Berman was shot in the back of the head, execution style, once. The case was never solved, but he's always been under that umbrella of suspicion. Now they say they had probable cause to arrest him after the HBO documentary series about Durst called The Jinx. Okay, so that's kind of the background. But Durst is being held without bail in New Orleans, where he was arrested, because once the FBI found him at a JW Marriott in New Orleans, they searched his room. They did an inventory search, which is the defense is now challenging whether or not it's proper, and they found a loaded .38 caliber gun and 5 ounces of marijuana. So he's being held on weapons and marijuana charges, even though he has agreed to go back to California to face the murder charge. New Orleans or Louisiana wants to deal with him first. So he's held without bail. He's a flight risk, because when he was arrested in the past, in 2001, for murder there, he fled to Pennsylvania and was brought back and was arrested for murdering a neighbor and charged and tried, but that he was found to be not guilty by reason of self-defense. In any event, this is a guy who may have left dead bodies around the country, not just his friend in 2000, his neighbor in 2001, but his missing wife from 1982. He's always been a suspect in that but never charged in New York. Now authorities, our FBI, is asking local police departments to take a look at unsolved cases in parts of the country where Durst had a nexus. So they're taking a look at a missing unsolved case in Middlebury, Vermont. They're looking at a case in Eureka, California, as well as other places where missing women. students. One was a 16-year-old in California, a Middlebury college student in Vermont. He has a preliminary hearing coming up April 2nd, so a week from tomorrow, in New Orleans on the weapons and drug charge. He's facing 10, 50, maybe up to even 20 years just on those charges. If Louisiana doesn't let him go back to California, he's going to turn 72 next month. A couple of weeks, he's going to be 72. He's not in great health. This may be over. If he's convicted and sentenced and stays in Louisiana, that may be the end of the game for him. We'll see.
Beth, let's go back to the Vermont situation, because that's pretty new. And can you describe for our listeners why they think Robert Durst may be involved in a homicide in Vermont?
Well, they're just taking a look at it. It's not, you know, there's a very little nexus. However, Durst and his then wife, now missing, Kathy, owned a health food restaurant. And this student had just been in the restaurant where she bought some prunes or something like that. Not the restaurant. It was a health food store. And she had just purchased something there. So that's the nexus. That's the last she was seen. So I think that's a very cold trail.
Isn't that the All Good Things store, which is the name for the movie which Andrew Jarecki did before the groundbreaking documentary?
You know more than I do, because I hadn't read that that's a name. If so, that's interesting. I mean, that's not a coincidence.
Yeah, so I mean, I read about that there is that connection in Vermont, and it sounds like they are working that cold case. We'll see what comes out of that. I also saw some news, Beth, I don't know if you saw it, that there are more allegations that Robert Durst had been stalking his brother. Did you see anything about that?
Yeah, Douglas Durst has had a restraining order on him for some time, and actually lived in fear, so he says, always looking over his shoulder at what his brother might do. You know, his brother, Robert Durst, had a lot of money. I mean, the family paid him over $60 million. He's basically estranged from the family, not involved with the family business. And Douglas was concerned that his brother, he believed, you know, was capable of murder and had murdered in the past. You know, and he thought he might be doing the same to him.
Now, what's the next thing we can expect in the Robert Durst case? What's the next event, next court date? What are we looking at here?
Well, April 2nd is the preliminary hearing on the weapons and marijuana charges. Now, New Orleans could alternatively go in the grand jury. Between, you know, Monday was the last hearing where no bail was set. It was simply a bail hearing. They could go in the grand jury, which would then mean a preliminary hearing is not necessary. Preliminary hearing is an alternative to a grand jury presentation. So we're not really sure what the New Orleans Parish, the district attorney there, is going to do. But at Monday's hearing a couple of days ago, Dick DeGaren, the Texas attorney who successfully defended Durst on the charge of killing and dismembering his neighbor in 2001. I mean, the killing was in 2001. Yeah. He's taking the lead at this point, and he really wanted to argue the sufficiency of the evidence for an arrest and a search. And the district attorney kept saying, Judge, you know, we're not going to be litigating that right now. We're here today on a bail hearing and determining whether or not he's a flight risk. And even Durst in the HBO documentary admits, you know, that, you know, you charge someone with murder, like in the Texas case, so you set $250,000 bail, goodbye, I'm gone, goodbye, jail. He says something to that effect in the documentary. So he himself, you know, admits, you better not give me bail or I'm going to flee. So that was kind of a no-brainer, and the defense did not expect to get bail set in Louisiana. But DeGaren was taking the opportunity to try to, at least at this point, start arguing the sufficiency of the evidence for the arrest. Now, they had the warrant for first-degree murder, but DeGaren is saying that the FBI may not have been fully advised of the warrant, something like that, at the time, so that when they did the inventory search of Durst's hotel room, that it was an improper search and that anything gathered in that hotel room, you know, could very well be suppressed, which would mean those Louisiana charges will be out the window. But that wasn't litigated Monday. He started to try to do that, but was cut off.
Beth, Beth Karras on crime.com. Beth, we're out of time, but thanks so much, as always, for being with us. I know you'll continue to follow this very interesting investigation of Robert Durst for us. Good luck on the show, and I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye, Beth. Okay, now, the answer to the question of the day. The question of the day is, what are the costs of drunk driving in America, and what can be done to reduce drunk driving tragedies like the tragedy involving Pedro Abad Jr., which occurred this past weekend in Staten Island? Answer, the human costs of drunk driving are horrific. According to Mothers Against Drunk Driving, MAD.org, approximately 28 people die a day as a result of drunk driving crashes. Now, on the financial side, the financial costs, according to MAD.org, amount to $199 billion per year in the United States. I don't know if those figures are accurate, but even if they're half right, it's astounding. So what can be done? Number one, we can increase the employment of breath alcohol ignition interlock devices, including lengthening the periods of the time an ignition interlock device is affixed to a perpetrator's vehicle. Number two, we are developing new technologies to reduce those with a history of drunk driving from starting their cars if they have a high enough blood alcohol content. I understand that there are mechanisms more advanced than these current ignition interlock devices that are in the works and being developed to combat drunk driving further. Three, we need more frequent employment of police sobriety checkpoints, which could deter and catch drunk drivers. Four, we need more emphasis on educating our young people about the tragic consequences of drinking and driving. Five, proactive participation from our bars and restaurants to help detect potential drunk drivers before they leave the bar or the restaurant. And the last point that I make is something I remember from high school. I grew up in a suburb of New York, and I remember even in high school, if you're at a party and some student was drunk, all they had to do was call a number, and a sober driver would come pick them up, no questions asked. Perhaps that's something that should be employed with the grown-ups to prevent tragedies. I can't help but wonder, had Pedro Abad Jr., the New Jersey police officer, not been permitted to remove the breath alcohol ignition interlock device from his vehicle in September of last year, maybe the lives of Frank Vigiano and Joseph Rodriguez would have been spared instead of lost in Saturday's accident on the West Shore Expressway in Staten Island after a night of partying at a strip club. Thank you to Peter Gerstenzang, author handling the DWI case in New York. Get his book from West Publishing. If you practice DWI law in New York, that is a must-have reference. Beth Karras, KarrasOnCrime.com, thank you for your Durst update, as always. I want to thank my producer, Mark Goldman, who always does a great job. Follow me on Twitter, at Dan Hochheiser, HOCHHEISER. Like our Facebook page, facebook.com/talkinglaw. Email me with suggestions for how to improve the show, guests, other ideas, talkinglaw@gmail.com, no G, talkinglaw@gmail.com. Our next show is next Wednesday, 9:30 a.m. We will have Gary L. Hayward, author, corruption officer from jail guard to perpetrator inside Rikers Island, and also former New York Mets center fielder Mookie Wilson, best known for hitting the slow ground ball through the legs of former Boston first baseman Bill Buckner in Game 6 of the 86 World Series. He will discuss his new book with us. Mookie, I want to wish everybody peace and justice. Take care.